Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome, SBGAN podcast listeners, and welcome back to SBGAN Journal Club. At Journal Club today, we have a manager's special. The podcast supermarket, go to aisle two, listeners, is offering two-for-ones on interviewees. The tag team are Dr. Caroline Schneider of the Rheinisch-Westfälische Technische Hochschule Aachen, in Aachen, of course, and to Dr. Jake Mann of Birmingham. Well, Jake is Jake, but he's the bloke that you all know, or so let's hope, from faithful attendance at SBGAN Journal Club. There's no need to rabbit on about him. But Dr. Schneider is a new rocket, certainly someone who's riding a new rocket. She comes from Neuss, the garden spot of the Ruhrpott, across the river Rhine from Düsseldorf, and she stayed close to home for her medical training. Her favorite food since earliest childhood was Printen, a regional type of gingerbread, and the emblem of the city of Aachen, Charlemagne's capital. So when the time came to study medicine, she headed a few kilometers to the southwest, matriculated at, I'm not going to try that again, let's just say RWTH, Aachen University, and took all the prizes. She now heads a laboratory at her alma mater, administratively within the Department of Gastroenterology, and her print-infueled career rocket is powered by artificial intelligence, we'll call that AI from here on in, that is to say, by the use of AI to mine large data sets for features that may be of value in population screening. She and Jake have recommended two articles for listener attention. One is titled, Learning the Natural History of Human Disease with Generative Transformers, and the other, Machine Learning Predicts Hepatocellular Carcinoma Risk from Routine Clinical Data, a Large Population-Based Multicentric Study. The latter is from Dr. Schneider's team. The former describes use of GPTs, that is, Generative Pre-trained Transformers, a form of AI, to model health trajectories for populations and to identify biomarker combinations of predictive value for morbidity of multiple etiologies. The latter uses AI as well, again seeking biomarker combinations, but those associated predictively with the particular single disorder of hepatocellular carcinoma. Right, okay, draw breath, and I'm going to recommend to you, you folks at home, to seek out these publications, and elsewhere on the SBGAN website, you can find a précis of this podcast that contains the full bibliographic data. Pore over them, then come back to the podcast and listen again. Why? Well, to cite Mark Twain, the statements are interesting but tough. They are written in epidemiology and in statistics, and neither of those is a language that many of us speak. And to plow through those articles and to emerge at the other end feeling even transiently that one has understood them is, well, tough. So we're on a listener's pilgrimage to the celestial city of comprehension. The metaphor is from John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, as were the statements on which Mark Twain commented. But only to a certain extent can their unaided efforts today make another biblical quote here, the crooked straight and the rough places plain. So help them. Pause, read, ponder, come back, and make time to listen to this podcast more than once. Caroline, did I make any misstatements there, aside from the entirely fictional business about Printen?
So actually, I do enjoy Printen, but I also like many other foods. But thank you very much for the kind introduction.
Okay. AI. AI seems way beyond me, not just in terms of comprehension, but also in terms of daily application. I'm a clinician. Well, I'm not, but if I'm, for purposes of cosplay here, I am a clinician. And I see kids in an outpatient department. And what does AI mean to me?
I think AI as a broad term will actually change all our lives and is already changing them. But I think what we are lacking at the moment is actually well-applicable AI that can make our lives easier. And especially in an outpatient clinic, you don't need the fancy multi-omics models, but you might need something that can help you make a decision a bit faster.
We've got Google for that.
I think Google is already quite good, but actually the questions that we ask are sometimes so specialized that Google might not be the right place to place your question.
I can grant that, okay. Well, do you still see patients?
At the moment, I'm pausing my clinical training because there's so much interest in the research that I do, but I did full-time research training for a couple of years, and I will continue starting on the 1st of September again with clinic.
Then maybe I should turn that question to our pal Jake. Jake, tell us about your using AI day-to-day on the clinical wards.
Well, the party line at Birmingham Children's Hospital is that no AI tools are approved for use. Therefore, I am not using any AI tools in my day-to-day clinical practice. However, hypothetically, and as far as I'm aware, that some of my colleagues may use them for simple things like turning your dictation or listening to a conversation between a clinician and the parent and the child and turning it into a pre-formatted clinic note, or helping you with coming up with ideas for a differential diagnosis that you haven't thought about. But, Carolyn, your work is a bit more complicated, not necessarily more complicated, but more advanced from that. And, I mean, if I've understood your recent cancer discovery paper correctly, the headline that I took away was that using effectively routine data stored in our electronic health records, we can get a better prediction model of HCC, albeit in adults, than could be generated using any of the fancy genome-wide data, serum proteomics, or any of the existing clinical tools. Is that right?
So actually, I was also quite surprised, especially also as I worked in genetics also in the past. So especially about the finding that none of the single nucleotide polymorphisms that we included in the model showed up in the top 15 model in the end. This was actually really surprising to me. And I think it points us in a good direction where AI can actually be useful, because if we can start with a quite complex data set, but actually for this particular type of cancer, find out in the end that routine parameters are actually enough to already stratify patients in high risk, I think that's quite interesting. On the other hand, I don't want to say that genetics are useless. So I'm absolutely in favor, and my heart still pounds for genetics. But just the way that we included them might be also a bit biased, because if you include a single variant, the effect size might not be strong enough. So actually for our future work, we will also include polygenic risk scores or multiple variants in one pathway to really see their effect. But I think for our application in a primary care setting to really find patients that should see a hepatologist, I think this model is actually already quite good.
How does that advance, say, just, periodic sonography for cirrhosis?
So one interesting finding of our study was actually that the diagnosis of cirrhosis often occurred after the HCC diagnosis was done. So we could basically show that cirrhosis is missed it often. And to find those patients which might have cirrhosis and might therefore also have more risk of hepatocellular carcinoma is also one way. But we could actually show that our model is better than just the diagnosis of cirrhosis alone, because it was a question we already got, because the patients with cirrhosis, they receive screening. So if cirrhosis alone was already a good predictor, then our model might not be needed. But I think especially also in the recent change of risk factors with the rise of steatotic liver diseases.
And the fall off from hepatitis C. Yes, okay.
Exactly. There are these changes in risk factor which might make a model necessary that also picks up on these risk factors, which might not be found just in focusing on patients with the cirrhosis that is already existent.
What has the identification of the risk factors led you to wonder about carcinogenesis in the liver?
That's actually a very good question. And one thing that I can say is that we looked also at biases in our model, because this is something that I'm very interested in, because you learn garbage in, garbage out.
True.
And we tried to regulate the amount of garbage that go in our model. But you also have to check yourself if you qualify for these biases. And we saw that for females, for example, our score performed worse than for males. And this is not that we did not include enough females in the training, because we have 50% males and females roughly in the training data set. But if we look at the HCCs that occur, they are 80% in males. So there is an imbalance. And one thing that we are now doing for future studies is also to look at just at females and to understand the differences, why our current model might not be perfect for this population. And I think you can extrapolate this also for other underrepresented groups in our current training data.
So gender, all right. And then the question of how does female gender exert a protective effect? Or how does masculine gender increase risk? I think those are two different sides of one coin.
My hypothesis is that it's mostly lifestyle related, but there might be also some underlying factors. There have been some studies published, especially in also ways, pathways that are mostly activated in females but not in males, also in relation to sex hormones, for example. So this is an interesting area to explore, because also in one of these data sets we have measurements of the sex hormones, which have not come up in our general model. So I'm quite interested on how this will play out in the future models.
We're all interested in how that will play out in the future models. We're all sitting back and waiting for you to provide to interpret the implications of your data. But again, using AI in your clinical practice, it's forbidden in Birmingham. I've abandoned Birmingham. What a great line.
I feel like that's a slight exaggeration from the official party line at Birmingham Children's and Women's Foundation Trust. I'm sure that elsewhere in Birmingham, AI is alive and well in clinical implementation. It is like everything, you have to be sure about where the data is going and that it has been passed through the necessary safeguards and you're not accidentally uploading identifiable data to a server without consent. And just in my individual hospital at this stage, they're still evaluating how it can be used within appropriate guidelines.
And what about at the, I have to look this up now because I don't refer to it every day. How about at the hospital of the RWTH Aachen University?
I think it's the same rules. But actually, the calculator, right, for our HCC model, for research purposes, it's possible to try it out, but only for research purposes. And I'm also convinced that we have to hold these new models also to the same standards. So I would not encourage anyone to use our model yet, but we are obviously trying to also validate it in clinical trials. And after it has been validated, I think if it proves useful, it might be a good addition.
That is fantastic. Jake, you had a comment.
Could I just ask one other question about your paper? Just thinking again about the intersection of genetics and the way that you did your study, could it be that by integrating the data of characteristics, blood tests, you are indirectly measuring the effect of the genetics? So even adding more genetic data in, genome-wide polygenic risk score, you would see no improvement? Do you have any inklings to whether that would be the case or not?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because I was also quite surprised by this. And then I thought about it, how these genetic variants were discovered. And many of them were discovered by GWAS studies using ALT as a proxy for steatotic liver disease or for any type of liver disease. And therefore, my hypothesis at least is that they are already reflected in the elevated transaminases. But I think we will also study this further and hopefully can then really dissect these effects.
Well, what are the main opportunities that you envision for AI in rare disease studies?
So I think especially in rare diseases, I think we have to be very careful with the data that we put into the model, because if we only have a few cases, I think we have to really make sure that we are aggregating as many data sources as possible, right, for the input. But if we are able to do this also in consortia, really pulling together all these large data sets, we only started now with two, but also I'm envisioning it to be a worldwide effort. And then I think we can be more sure of the models that we develop, that they are really picking up features of those rare diseases which are applicable to many different populations, not just to one. Because I cannot even be sure if the model that we develop for HCC, which is not super rare, can hold true in the population that I see in Germany, because it was only US and UK patients that we trained it on. So I think that's actually the first thing that I have now to show, that it's not just effects that are only true in these two populations. And I think for even more rare diseases, we need even larger efforts to ensure this.
How do you recommend that trainees shape their potential careers with regard to AI?
Yeah, so that's something that I'm thinking a lot about, because we get many emails from medical students who would like to be involved. So I have managed to train now 3 students who came to our group without any knowledge about models or modeling to use the existing pipelines for a specific question. And doing this, we have compiled also a resource of publicly available information, which is approved by us that it's useful, because there's so much out there and that you can start to get into the topic. But you need good resources to really understand how to build a model from the beginning. And there are so many different paths now to go into, so that I can only encourage every student or doctor who wants to go into the topic to look for validated public resources, but then also to look at your data that you hopefully have for your PhD or MD, and to try to apply it. And I think by learning by doing, it might be something that, that is the most useful. And then obviously apply to a group which can help you along the way.
Right. Well, Jake, your hand is up.
I was just going to say, if I'm going to be devil's advocate here, from being somebody who spends a lot of their time in wet lab science at the bench, I tend to ask students or people to consider that, yes, AI is growing so rapidly, they must have an understanding of it. But I could see that in 15, 20 years' time, there will be even greater scarcity. Greater scarcity, does that make sense? Greater scarcity, yes.
Less abundance.
Less abundance, thank you. There will be even less abundance of wet lab science-trained MDs in particular. Because no matter how good an AI model gets, it will become very difficult to physically pipette one clear colorless fluid from one tube into another. So I'm here campaigning to keep a little bit of wet lab science going alongside learning how to code.
I think that every automobile should be issued a buggy whip socket.
But I also agree with that. So I think the wet lab skills will be much more important, especially now as the coding agents are getting quite good. I think you have to decide either to understand code on a very high level or to learn some wet lab skills to be also future-proof.
Good enough. How did you happen to wander... No, you did. You did it with a goal. You knew what you want. No, you're shaking your head. You're saying it just fell into place.
Yes, in hindsight, I can say that I was quite lucky. But after finishing medical school, I applied for the postdoctoral fellowship. And already during medical school, I was doing my MD. I worked on large data. So this was already something that I had decided to go into. But then deciding for the postdoctoral fellowship, the advice that I got was to do something, to learn a wet lab skill and not to go into big data. But there was a very good opportunity to go to the University of Pennsylvania and to work there with the Penn Medicine Biobank, which was a very large biobank that is existing at this center under the leadership of Professor Rader, who was the supervisor of my postdoctoral fellowship. And actually, I came to him to do also a recall by genotype study, to actually invite people with a specific genotype and then to do also in-depth phenotyping. But due to the pandemic, it was not possible to go through with that. But we had access to all this data and also the opportunity to learn from the best there. So actually, then it fell nicely into place. And I continued down this path, and especially in Germany, because I lose so many postdoctoral fellows that stay in the US, there's then an opportunity to go back and to start your research group, which is what I did.
That raises a follow-up question. How do you view your work in the context of the Schmalko et al. Paper on learning the natural history of human disease with generative transformers?
Yeah, so when I read that paper, I actually experienced FOBO, right? The fear of being obsolete by AI, because we are working so hard on handcrafted small algorithms that can predict one disease at a time. And they developed this huge model, which can predict more than 1,200 diseases up to 20 years in advance. So I was quite impressed by that paper. And I think also how they used the technology of adapting the ChatGPT architecture actually was quite impressive. But I still think that there's an opportunity to develop these handcrafted models, because what they do is they predict trajectories of different diseases and to predict the next disease in an already existing row of diseases. And how I view their work is actually that this offers an opportunity for prevention.
Indeed.
And this leads me then back to the screening, for example, of hepatocellular carcinoma, where we need to find a group of high-risk patients that we might screen with ultrasound. So I think both can be true at the same time, that we have these large foundational models, which can already give us a good opportunity of inviting people to then apply a handcrafted, specialized algorithm to find the high-risk group.
So we have a public health approach, in effect, from the Nature paper, and we have an individual disease approach with the work that you've pioneered.
And I think, relevant to our society and our work, where we're working in predominantly rare or rarer diseases, I think that the model that Nature paper had done is unlikely to be directly applicable because of the data set it was trained on. Trained on the UK Biobank participants, 40 years and older, generally more white, more healthy than the general population, whereas we would need a model that is trained on, well, firstly, children, and then encompasses rare diseases. I do wonder about things like a birth cohort study, but clearly then you would need multiple birth cohort studies to capture even a few of these rare conditions. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it?
So I hope not. And I'm particularly looking forward to the European health data space, right, which might give us the first opportunity of doing something like this in a Europe-based approach, but obviously not for the omics parameters, but maybe already for the routine parameters. But something to add to that is that the model of the Nature paper actually learned that you cannot die before 40, right, because there was no death that occurred before 40. And I think this also highlights one of the shortcomings of these really excellent algorithms.
Well, then, here I am. I recognize that I'm eligible for death, sadly. But before I go, I do want to thank you very much for making yourself available for our SBGAN Journal Club today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Jake, old man, nice to see you here.
Nice to see you. Thanks, Alex.